As Australia prepares to send another 300 troops to Iraq to help fight the Islamic State group, a debate has erupted over the religious roots of ISIS. In a cover story in this month's edition of Atlantic magazine, investigative journalist Graham Wood argues, yes, ISIS is psychopathic, but it's much, much more. He also warns of a scenario worse than the current bloodshed in Syria and Iraq, if you can believe it, and suggests a response that will surprise you. Before Atlantic even hit the newsstands, the online world was furious. Critics said Graham Wood was blaming the Islamic faith for ISIS. So is he?
No, absolutely not. And I make clear in the piece, too, that not only is it not the inevitable outcome of Islamic doctrine, it's not even the inevitable outcome of literalist Islamic doctrine. Most literalists are against the Islamic State. What it is, however, is an entity that looks to Islamic tradition, which is a vast and often contradictory things, and it uses the texts of Islam to justify itself. It doesn't look outside of that tradition. It draws conclusions that are very different from what the vast majority of Muslims would draw, but it's absolutely an Islamic entity in the sense of being in that tradition.
It reaches back to a medieval school of Islam, a school that is well within the Islamic tradition. But how far does it have to go back to find part of the doctrine to justify the excesses?
Typically, if you were to ask the people of the Islamic State how far to go back, they would say that the sources of authority of Islam are the Quran, the Hadith, that is the sayings of the Prophet Muhammad, and the behavior of the immediate generations that followed the Prophet himself. So we're talking going back to 1300 years ago.
So what in the current behavior, the excesses, the psychopathic excesses of Islamic State do you see rooted in a particular, but nonetheless valid interpretation of Islam?
The practices that we think of as most atrocious would certainly include slavery, crucifixion, beheadings, amputations. And these have textual basis. Almost all Muslims today would reject these practices, just like Jews and Christians would reject the stoning of adulterers and so on. But certainly in Islamic texts from that early era, there is very clearly a description of when slavery is permitted and under what conditions, which crimes are supposed to be punished by amputation or by stoning or by crucifixion and beheading. These are in the text, unfortunately.
I mean, I think it's important to clarify this because you have been subject to some blowback. You explicitly state that this is an extreme minority school of Islam, don't you?
Yes, and we could find extreme minority schools, in fact, apocalyptic death cults that are part of Christianity or Judaism too. And it's important to mention that these Christian death cults are not considered the correct interpretation of Christianity by most Christians. By the same token, the Islamic State is not considered the correct interpretation of Islam by the vast majority of Muslims.
But I mean, you do use the phrase that Islamic State is very Islamic.
Yes, and by that I mean that the Islamic State looks into the Islamic traditions for its authority. It does not look outside of them. There are ways it could have tried to justify itself by using secular sources of authority or morality. It just doesn't do that. It doesn't recognize these things as so. And so it tries very hard to be a thoroughbred version of Islam. And I think Muslims have generally rejected its attempt to do that, but nonetheless, that's where it sees its modes of justification, its modes of speaking, its rhetoric.
One of the most perceptive points that came out is you point out that the West is deluded in not wanting to associate Islamic State with a particular kind of Islamic doctrine. And it's only partly out of a sort of liberal, tolerant values. They're also deluded because, I mean, I think you've said that the West says, well, if religion isn't a factor in the governments of Washington and Berlin, they can't perceive it being a factor in places like Mosul and Raqqa.
Yes, there's an attempt, and sometimes it's misguided, sometimes it's well-intentioned, to assume that they think the way we do. And, you know, the whole discipline of, say, anthropology would suggest that there are complicated carefully constructed ways of thinking that are not our own. And I think the Islamic State exemplifies that. The way that we have suggested that it's actually just a bunch of crazy people, that they have no ideology at all, I think actually reflects a view of non-Westerners and Muslims in particular as barbarians who can't think, who can't possibly have the same kind of complicated political and religious commitments that we have. Sure enough, if you look at their doctrine, they have a very, very carefully considered textual literalist tradition. And I think it's important to understand them by understanding what that tradition is.
There was a piece written in response to your cover story saying, well, look, if Islamic State enslaves, it maims, it murders, it ethnically cleanses, it burns, it beheads, it does all of this, the writer isn't denying it, why can't it lie, basically? Why do we give it purity in its interpretation of a particular school of Islam when it's capable of all these other atrocities?
It certainly could lie, and I think many of the justifications that it gives are, even as an outsider, I could say that they look quite tendentious as interpretations of Islamic law. That said, it could lie, but then again, it works pretty hard to lie even to itself, if that's the case. They have a council of scholars that mass produces, at an industrial scale, it's putting out fatwas, trying to justify what it does. I think this is an unnecessary exercise if it's being cynical. I think it's much more likely that this is a sincere group that's trying to find its justification in this textual tradition.
And, I mean, you have to constantly rush to reassure people. Your use of the term sincere there implies absolutely no sympathy with its objectives. It's simply the point that you're making, that it believes its jihad is Islamically authentic.
Yes, the list of sincere death cults includes almost all death cults. The religious traditions out there that disagree with the Islamic State are also mostly sincere. It doesn't mean we have to take them at face value with everything that they say, but it's an interesting impulse when someone beheads an apostate and says God is great to say, oh, he's not doing that for any religious reason whatsoever.
One of the other points that really, I think, informed a lot of us who read your piece was that you draw a major distinction between Islamic State and Al-Qaeda. Now, in some sense, we see them as almost one in the same, their psychopathic violence, their adherence to the idea of a caliphate, but there's a big difference, and what is it?
There are two big differences. One is that Al-Qaeda has, in the past, really aimed at Western countries. They've wanted to hit Australians, Americans, Canadians. And the Islamic State really focuses on the near enemy and specifically on other Muslims. So Al-Qaeda has been very cautious, or more cautious than the Islamic State by far anyway, about attacking, for example, Shia in Iraq or Sufis. They have serious doctrinal differences with these groups, but they've thought it was at the very least bad PR. The Islamic State kills these groups zealously. It's the main activity of the group, in fact. The other thing that's different is that the apocalyptic views of Al-Qaeda, while they match the Islamic State's, they're not on anything like the accelerated timetable that the Islamic State prefers. So Islamic State thinks that these things are happening within a few years. Al-Qaeda might have to wait a few millennia.
Yeah. And that was the whole point about Osama bin Laden, that this guy was a long-range planner. Yeah, I mean, 9/11, I think, was a decade in the planning.
Yes, that's right. And he had very clearly articulated political grievances and objectives that he would air. Whereas the Islamic State, although it has certainly some of those, often its rhetoric is entirely about the end of times and a kind of battle that won't be won except by the grace of God himself.
But I think your piece points out that there is maybe the potential for some amalgamation or reconciliation between Islamic State and Al-Qaeda, and that really is, if there's a nightmare scenario worse than IS, this is it.
Right. The Islamic State certainly rejects the leadership of Al-Qaeda. That's Ayman al-Zawahiri, who's probably somewhere in Pakistan or Afghanistan right now. There is a possibility, though, that the satellite groups of Al-Qaeda will decide that they've just been backing the wrong horse and would like to switch over. And if they join the Islamic State, then they really will have some kind of regional axis encompassing areas of Libya already, certainly Syria and Iraq, but they could add to that Yemen, Somalia, possibly Nigeria.
This is the Religion and Ethics Report with me, Andrew West. I'm speaking with the leading American journalist, Graham Wood. Graham is a contributing editor at The Atlantic magazine, which published his recent cover story, What ISIS Really Wants. A provocative cover story sparked a lot of debate. We're joining that debate today. Graham, why your cover story is also particularly apposite to Australia is that you met the Australian ISIS recruiter, Musa Cerentonio. Now, first of all, you said that you had this, and you hated yourself for it, but you had this rather perverse liking for the guy.
Yes, I spoke with him for a few hours, and I would have happily spoken to him for several hours more. He's a fascinating individual. He is in favor of slavery. He's in favor of amputations and beheadings. So this obviously colors my recollection of these conversations. But he's also very serious and scholarly in the way that he approached Islam. And he would answer any question that I had. There was nothing that was too ridiculous. There was nothing that was too picayune. He is someone who takes these things very seriously and sees himself as part of this massive battle that I'm describing between the Islamic State and the West. It's rare that you're in the presence of someone who has such a clear view of good and evil, and it's a very interesting experience. There, are Muslim scholars who would say that his point of view is extremely wrong, seriously deviant, and he would take them on too. It's not to say that he's right or that they're right, but certainly he's thought these things through very carefully and can contest anyone who says otherwise.
Why is territory, the physical holding of territory, so important to the Islamic State project, both practically and theologically?
You can compare them to Al-Qaeda in this regard. Al-Qaeda being an underground network, cellular and autonomous, each cell operating differently from the rest. And the Islamic State, by contrast, is insistent that it has to hold territory to be legitimate in the most important sense of being a caliphate. A caliphate has to be able to implement Sharia law fully, and it cannot do that if it's running around underground. And that's really, for someone like Cerentonio, one of the really signal developments in the Islamic State versus the previous jihadi movements. It has a valid caliph in the form of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, and it holds territory where Baghdadi can implement Sharia law. It really changes everything for them.
So you actually need a physical place where you rule, where you can, as you say, impose your law through fiat and force to be authentic.
Yes, that's the way they describe it. I spoke to some people who are fans of the Islamic State who said, Islam is a state and it's a religion. If you have the religion part, then certainly you can pray on your own, even if you're not living in Islamic State. But to be a full Muslim, according to them, you have to live in the state and in that territory where Sharia law is being implemented.
And that would suggest, though, that if the West and its Arab allies, its Muslim allies, go back in and try to seize the territory, that's the end of Islamic State. But you are very cautious about that. I mean, you're very honest about the massive bungling that took place in Iraq, which has effectively created the fertile ground. So you're cautious about going back in?
Yes, I think it's very tempting to go back in by their own admission. If you deprive them of territory, then there is no longer a caliphate. None of this applies any longer. On the other hand, I think, first of all, they want us to try to go back in because it confirms their propaganda narrative of crusaders versus Islam. But also, I think it's just necessary to have some humility about what happens when we go into these places and try to occupy and govern them. In the past, when we tried it, it created the chaos that, as you say, is the progenitor of the Islamic State. It's where the Islamic State came from. I don't know what the consequence would be of trying to do that again, even if I'm confident, and I am, that a Western coalition, military coalition, could unseat the Islamic State and deprive it of that territory.
So you've proposed, as I understand, a kind of two-pronged strategy. One is, if you like, a continual physical harassment using airstrikes of Islamic State. But the other is a very interesting strategy. You say that the answer to ISIS extremism is another form of extremism, albeit one that's not acted out. What is that?
Well, there is a type of Salafism called quietism. It says that one of the things that you most want to avoid as a Muslim is chaos. It's disorder. And so this is one reason why the quietists say the Islamic State is deviant and sinful in creating what they have, because they say, look, you're creating fights among Muslims. The main thing to do here is to unite and to have a peaceful enough environment where Muslims can live pious lives. This is a kind of, it's a possible off-ramp for people who have a literalist bent and would otherwise be going toward the Islamic State. Yeah, I don't think it's a solution to the Islamic State, but it at least shows that there's a way to be a literalist, a way even to be someone who's, you know, medieval in orientation, that doesn't lead to the Islamic State, and in fact leads to a theologically grounded argument against the Islamic State that would be acceptable to the vast majority of Muslims.
But it does lead us into even a de facto alliance with still some pretty unsavory types. I mean, you point out that even the quietest Salafists, they're not liberal, they're not moderate by any means, are they?
No, they're not moderate at all. They are just as interested as the Islamic State in kind of turning back the clock to a legal environment of the 7th century. And in some ways, they're the dream citizens of a tyrant's kingdom, in that they believe that they have to follow whatever the ruler says, because if they don't, it'll create that chaos that they try to avoid so studiously. The number of Muslims for whom literalism has any appeal at all is already a small minority. So it just shows that of that small minority, it's another small minority that even goes in for the jihadist version of this at all.
That's the investigative journalist and Yale University teacher Graham Wood discussing his Atlantic magazine cover story, What ISIS Really Wants.